next on Think, why top schools, stellar grades, and excellent behavior don't feel like enough to many Indian American parents, and how they seek to fill in the gaps in their children's education. We'll spend this hour with sociologist Pavan Dhingra, who has studied the phenomenon he calls hyper-education, by which South Asian immigrant families and some of their well-to-do white neighbors enroll their kids in supplemental classes not to catch up to the rest of the class, but to get far ahead of it. We'll talk about how that affects the climate in the public schools these students attend, about the anxieties that drive these efforts, and about how students cope with their parents' sky-high expectations. Our conversation starts after a short break. There's an interesting phenomenon at work in places noted for their excellent public schools. A certain subset of parents, including a lot of Indian American parents, are not content to just have their kids attend those schools or even attend and excel. For these parents, eager to secure a path to success when they may lack the kinds of connections they imagine might grease the wheels for their kids' white classmates, acing school is just the beginning. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There are after-hours academic competitions like spelling bees and science fairs and expensive tutoring and enrichment, all designed not to catch students up to the rest of the class, but to vault them far ahead of it. Sociologist Pavan Dhingra is professor of American Studies at Amherst College, and he has a term for this. He calls it hyper-education. And although Dhingra understands the concerns about how these giant expectations affect individual students and their classmates who don't have access to extra instruction, he also says it's important to understand why parents believe they have no choice. His new book is called Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. Pavan, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So you open the book talking about the Scripps Howard National Spelling Bee. Here's comedian Hari Kondabolu talking about it in his stand-up routine.
If it isn't obvious yet, I love the spelling bee. Or as I like to call it, the Indian Super Bowl. Six winners in a row. Six in a row, son. That's incredible. So it gives me great pleasure to finally say, hey, white people, learn the language.
What was notable about the Scripps Howard Bee in 2019?
2019 was the last year we had the spelling because, you know, this past year it was canceled. And it was notable because there were actually eight co-champions as opposed to normally having one, right, champion. So that in itself was astounding. That's in historical. And out of those eight, seven were Indian American. So, you know, just imagine the odds of that happening. It's, you know, pretty phenomenal. And it speaks to Hari's jokes that Indians have been dominating this bee for years now. I mean, since year 2000, really, it's been a major trend. There's even a documentary on Netflix about this called Spelling the Dream.
So this speaks to Indian American students as like the newest group to be branded a model minority based on adult professional success, but also on the performance of many Indian American students in academic competitions. As a group, these students do well in school because school is just the beginning of their education?
Right. I mean, school is one part of their education. So I know you had Kathy Hong Park on a couple of days ago, and she spoke really well about the model minority stereotype, and I won't, you know, dwell on that, but I'm happy to talk more if you're interested. And we see a lot of these Indian American kids, the ones that are kind of on the stage or the most well-known, kind of represent this newest version of children who overachieve in education. Of course, a lot of South Asian kids don't, so I want to make sure your listeners know this. But you know, to your point, yeah, many of them do kind of excel inside and outside of the classroom. And I want to understand, why is this going on? What's the commitment behind this? Because they're not alone, right? So many kids are, as you alluded to at the beginning of the program, so many families, whether they're, you know, Asian, white, whichever group, are investing more time and money in after-school education when there's really no clear external need or pressures to do so. Concerned to do so. And I really want to get at why this is. And the Spelling Bee is one example of this kind of academic competitions, and there's others. But also, you know, the after-school tutoring company becomes another example of people seeking out education. So, you know, across the country, and Kumons and Mathnasiums and the like are some of the fastest growing companies in the country. So, you know, what's behind that? And what's leading families to say, my good school and my kid doing fine in school is not enough. I have to do more than that.
This is what you refer to as hyper-education. What convinces parents that the requirements of schools themselves are not enough to guarantee their children will be successful?
That's a great question. And I can talk about this for a very long time. I'll try to keep it brief. So, but there's various kind of motivations for this, why parents feel that they're great. They're finely resourced and well-ranked school is not doing enough for their kid. And this, you know, just to make it clear for the listeners, we're talking about young kids, like, you know, middle school, elementary school. Because if I have a child who's, you know, a junior in high school and I want them to do better on the SAT, then getting a tutor for that, you know, we may not like that practice, but there's a logic to that, right? It makes sense. But here we're talking about kids who have no external markers or trying to hit, and still parents are saying, we want to double down on academics outside of school. And the reasons for this there are a lot. So on the one hand, parents are saying, you know, I don't want to wait till high school to get my kid prepared for college and the competitiveness for AP classes or honors math classes come high school. And to have my child ready for that, it makes sense just to kind of start that process earlier, you know, by third grade. So they have a leg up over, quote, the competition, that is their, you know, third grade peers in their class. Other parents will say, you know, my kid's school may be doing fine in these subjects, but to not give my child this extra opportunity could be doing them a disservice. And so to prevent a problem, I want to create this kind of feel motivated to do this now. And for some immigrant parents, and you mentioned this really well at the beginning, immigrant parents may say, you know, I can't rely on my social connections or my wherewithal about how the America education system works to guide my kid through the process the way my neighbors might be able to. Right. So I need to make sure they have as much education as they can early on, so they have at least they can have a fighting chance, because they don't have the social networks. They don't know how to grease the wheel. They don't know how things work, the kind of hidden curriculum about this process. So there's various motivations behind this. And the last thing I'll just quickly say is this stuff isn't happening in a vacuum. It's not just parents kind of coming to concerns around this on their own. Right. I mean, our college admissions processes are more competitive. There's been a large amount of concern over the quality of our public schools, right or wrong, ranging from politicians to, you know, the Gates Foundation, and all the other places that make parents, you know, again, who are in fine schools, you know, well-ranked schools, who may move to towns because of the schools, still say, maybe I shouldn't trust what my school is giving my child, because I hear so many concerns around it. So going to the company down the road in my local strip mall makes sense. It just seems like the logical thing to do.
I wonder if immigrant parents are also keyed into global competition for jobs and resources in a way that people who have been born and raised and sort of lived their entire existence in the United States are not.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up. So I was talking with a school principal, really wonderful person, well-meaning. And she said, you know, when she was raising her kids, and this is now, you know, her kids are now grown, she said they were interested in woodworking and those kinds of things. And that's how she thought parents should raise their kids now. And she was really critical of the immigrant parents in her school district who were seeking extra education as opposed to, you know, woodworking or some other non-academic opportunity. And she, and her lesson basically was, if you just have your kid do these non-academic things, they'll grow up and they'll have their own interests and they'll do fine in school on their own, and they'll go off to whatever college, you know, that's the best suited for them. And I can understand that motivation. I can appreciate where she's coming from. But there is an assumption she carries that just by kind of going along with the standard expectations in this country, right, especially at a time when, you know, America's global dominance was pretty pronounced, and having some of the privileges that come with, whether that be whiteness or just American culture in general, will lead to kind of fine outcomes. But a lot of immigrant parents, that's not their point. That's not their reference point. And it's also not some assumptions that they can even hold, even if that was their reference point, because they see the global competition for jobs, for education back in their homeland. They themselves came to this country because they outcompeted someone else for a job. So they know the labor market is not kind of just confined to one geography, and college admissions is not confined to this one set of students applying. So their kind of worldly, global point, mindset and kind of upbringing really shapes the sense of what's at stake, right, when you're thinking about how to prepare your kids for college.
I think everybody has a definition of success in their heads, and we might make the mistake of assuming our definition of success is the same as everyone else's, which might not be true. Is there a particular way Indian American immigrant parents define success in adult life?
That's a really astute question. I mean, it's nothing too distinct. We're not looking at kind of really severe differences here. I mean, success means kind of some of the standard things we might imagine for lots of people, which is, you know, financial security, a sense of belonging and community, feeling fulfilled in what you do. Parents that I met and who are very invested in this, right, they do have concerns and they worry about their kids' financial well-being, but they're very mindful of their happiness, their sense of fulfillment, and they kind of, you know, belie this kind of, you know, the tiger parent stereotype that these parents are just about kind of outcomes and not about well-being, right? These, you know, I talk to parents who are very mindful of the costs and benefits of having their kids in extra education. And even more so sometimes than the white parents I met who had their kids in extra education. I wouldn't say it's too distinct, even if they may have certain motivations that are more concerns around the ability of their kids to reach that kind of success, notion of success.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Pavan, because, you know, one of the concerns you have is that when people critique this way of doing school, of pursuing hyper-education, sometimes there's an assumption that parents are, you know, want their kids to be automatons or are not aware of the fact that some of these expectations cause stress. It doesn't sound like that was your experience in talking to parents or students.
Right. Yeah, very, very good point, because stress and anxiety are real problems. Like, that's not debatable. They're really pronounced in high schools across the country. But one thing I talk about in the book a lot is that these are issues in middle school and even elementary school. And teachers are recognizing some of these major concerns. They'll notice that kids can be nonverbal in the classroom. They talk about kindergartners crying because of stress, right? And this is not unique, and this is not part of just one, you know, ethnic group or something. And so what's behind this stress is, you know, there are a lot of different factors, but the pressure on academics at a younger age is more and more pronounced. I was talking with a health expert at a Boston suburban school district. She said, I talked to third graders and I asked them, what are you worried about? There's no kind of, you know, context to this question. She's not setting it up. She just asked them, what are you worried about? And third graders say, getting into college, the SAT, the state standardized, you know, achievement test. And she was astounded by this and really dismayed, right? So parents, as they kind of ask their kids or put their kids into extra educational spaces, inadvertently maybe creating a sense of stress or pressure on academics that they don't actually want to create. And that's true for, you know, whether it be Indians or non-Indians, right? And so they don't want their kids to be, you know, automatons, and they want them to be free thinking and you know, self-aware and self-fulfilled. But some of the things that parents do that we end up having cross purposes, that's hard to disentangle. And teachers really pick up on those negative effects that they see in the classroom.
My guest is sociologist Pavan Dhingra. He is professor of American Studies at Amherst College and author of a book called Hypereducation: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is sociologist Pavan Dhingra, who is professor of American Studies at Amherst College and author of a book called Hypereducation: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. All right, Pavan, I want to talk a little more about how families come to be convinced this is necessary. First of all, I want to draw a line under the point that while you are looking in particular at Indian American families here, they're not the only ones pursuing all this enrichment, and it didn't even originate with them necessarily. Can you talk about other kinds of parents who want their kids hyper-educated?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. We see like a lot of Indians or Asians kind of at the forefront of this, and so it makes sense that we think about this, and the book talks about that. But the book also talks about a lot of, you know, basically white families, U.S.-raised white families, who find this to be a necessary part of their kids' education. So, you know, Kumon and Mathnasium and these other tutoring companies are some of the fastest growing companies in the country, you know, of any kind. And that's not because of any kind of one small demographic, you know, seeking them out. And a lot of families will come to this because they think, you know, my kid enjoys math or my kid enjoys reading, and I want them to give them in the school, but not be challenging enough. There's a kind of a distrust in the school or in the teachers that draws them to this. Others will say, you know, I think that by giving my kids this kind of opportunity, I can instill in them certain values, right? Not just about academic abilities, but trying to be a good person. I remember talking with one parent who said, and I was pretty astounded by this. I asked her, you know, why are you doing this? And what are your concerns you have and such? And she said, you know, my grandparents survived the Holocaust. My parents put me through college through hard work. And that's why I want my child in this, you know, after school math class once a week. So in her mind, she drew a straight line from surviving the Holocaust to having her child in an after school math program.
Wow.
Because both, I mean, all of that to her, it meant committing to hard work, you know, valuing, putting in the effort to get to where you want to be, not thinking that things will just come to you. So parents put a lot of meaning into these things that well beyond the academic kind of effects that, you know, ostensibly that we're paying for.
And of course, there are market forces at work here as well. There are the market forces that, you know, dictate who gets particular jobs, who gets paid what. But there are also markets selling this extra education to parents.
Oh, right. Yeah. And so, again, this doesn't take place in a vacuum of parents like insecurities or wants, right? I mean, these are, they're advertised this way. You know, Mathnasium is partnering with, you know, the national PTA to bring its services into school. So parents are seeing it inside the schools, not just like as they drive past the storefront. And the marketing is targeted oftentimes to families who are middle class or upper middle class. I remember talking with the director of a center, and he said, you know, he's a limited marketing budget. So when he does outreach, you know, you're able to purchase, you know, certain, you know, people to kind of send flyers to based on their income level and zip codes. So he targets families that make over $100,000 a year, thinking, you know, this is my best way to get people more bang for my buck. A different tutoring company I spoke to, their founders, and their growth plan is to grow in neighborhoods that already have very well-resourced and well-ranked schools. So if we think of tutoring as a way to help students, again, catch up to grade level or equalize their learning, this is the exact opposite, right? And I'm not saying that parents doing this are making a mistake or somehow this is, this has to be completely stopped or anything. What I'm trying to say is that there are meaningful consequences to these decisions. And sometimes parents don't realize some of the negative effects for their own kids by getting tutored. I talk to teachers who say that they think that youth who are getting these after-school learning end up learning less in their classrooms than those who aren't. So there's a lot of consequences, long-term and short-term, to draw out.
I want to talk also about the consequences for students who don't have access to all this education. Mm-hmm. One of my sons worked at Mathnasium for a while, and it paid really well because it's not cheap to send your kid there. You know, how do classmates stand a chance at competing with peers who are maybe 2 years ahead of grade level and making straight A's at everything because they have this outside of school supplementary education?
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. I'll talk about that in a couple of ways. One is just to the financial aspect of this, right? These can cost, up to a couple $100 a month, and there's not much financial aid, right? Given, and well, No Child Left Behind gave money to families to afford tutoring. Those are only under, pretty severe conditions. Their school had to be sort of be under, failing school for many years, and income, they had to have certain income needs. So for a large number of families, right, they're not going to have kind of any kind of financial aid to get into these, and they can't afford to have these kinds of options for themselves. So it really does benefit, those who have the most resources in at the end of the day. And the effects on those who aren't getting these extra education outside of school are many, right? So one of them, as you just said, right, I'm not going to get into the honors math class or the AP class because there are people who are just ahead of grade level. Even though I'm at grade level, even though I'm doing just fine in school, I'm not able to keep up with this education arms race that's taking place. And the other consequence on those children can be, emotional, right? One health expert I spoke to said she sees something she calls academic bullying. Right, the sense that if you're not doing, if you're not well above grade level and not taking advanced classes, somehow you're not worthy. And she sees a lot of students feel this way, even though, again, they're doing just fine in school. So it really warps children's impressions of their own abilities, right? And again, that's one of the other real social consequences of this, not to mention kind of, furthering our educational gap between those who have more resources and those who don't have access to these things.
And I can't help but feel for like the B students of the world who,
Right.
according to the standards of their school, their teachers, they're doing pretty well, but they're going to be pushed way down in the class rankings and have a really hard time looking attractive to colleges, even though they might have great potential as students and as adults in careers.
Yeah, I talked to college counselors as part of the book as well. Like, I'm sorry, not college counselors, college admissions officers, those behind the table, evaluating applications. And what do you think about these extracurricular math classes or these math competitions or spelling or whatever else it might be? And I would expect them to say, yeah, the more you do this, just the better off you are, the more advanced of the candidate you are. And to some degree, that's true. But one thing they said, I think I really want people to appreciate, is that if your child is not enjoying this activity, if they're doing it just to build up a college resume, then college admissions officers believe they can see through that. They can kind of tell when a family is pushing their child into this and when a family is supporting a child doing this. And that, so if if you're the one who is child is getting a B's and doing just fine, but not able to keep up with this, don't panic. Right? Don't feel that you have to do this in order to keep up and therefore to be able to accomplish something if it doesn't speak to your interests. Because, not to say that these admissions officers can read through all these, tea leaves, but they do believe that they're able to tell when a child is performing just for the sake of performing in a subject, and that does not necessarily lead them to admissions.
So that makes me feel a little better, except that, and I have faith in the good faith of college recruiters and admissions folks, but I think about those studies that found that sometimes East Asian students, in particular, East Asian American students, get judged as having like n personalities that aren't as good as their classmates of other races, and I wonder if there is a susceptibility to bias against students who were hyper-educated and given these classes. It can be really hard in a brief interview to tell whether someone is doing this
Right.
because it pleases mom and dad or if they're just nervous in the interview.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought this up because really it's a catch-22 here. So on the one hand, Asian American applicants are judged as being seen, as you said, like, are they going to be seen as one among many? You got this math class, you did this and X and Y, but also all of the other Chinese or Indian or Korean kids who are applying. And so you're just seen as one among many. You don't stand out. So in other words, you should not have done this. You should have done, instead of doing violin, you should have done saxophone or something else to kind of distinguish yourself. But on the other hand, right? There, you know, there's evidence to suggest that Asian Americans are held up to a higher standard for SAT test scores or GPAs or the like. And so if you don't do this extra work, right, to get your standardized test scores or GPA up to a level that's seen as appropriate for being of your ethnicity, then you're not going to be as qualified. So what you're basically stuck. You feel like you have to do these extra work in order to be seen as credible, but the fact that you do this extra work then creates you to, you know, makes you to be lack of personality, not distinguished, and everything else. So this is one of the, I think, one of the biases built into our college admissions process that I'm trying to, you know, bring out. And I'm speaking to it from the parents' point of view and the children's point of view as they try to navigate this.
So there's one other hazard that concerns me. You know, it's understandable that parents want these opportunities for their children. If they've got the resources, they will provide it. That almost always means paying for something outside of school time. I wonder if that means these same parents are not actively campaigning for the resources to make those services available to all students in a neighborhood public school by the school itself.
Yeah, that's a good question. So the parents, you know, that don't have unlimited funds, and we also don't have unlimited time. And if they feel that if the school provided, you know, opportunities for their children to pursue their interests at an advanced level or something else, they would take advantage of that. They would really like that. But they oftentimes feel that the school does not cater to students in that kind of with that academic kind of opportunity or ability. And so they feel like they have no choice but to go outside the classroom. Not to say that if there was these opportunities, they still wouldn't go outside, but they don't want to hoard these opportunities just for themselves, if you will, and think about it as a zero-sum game. Like that's not necessarily how they're seeing it. And in some ways, it's similar to, you know, youth sports. So youth sports, and I know you've covered this in your show, is a multi-billion-dollar industry now. You know, Little League is not enough anymore. And so this is the same kind of pattern we're seeing on the academic side of things, not just in the sports side of things, where going to the private sphere makes sense because that's the new normal. This is becoming the new normal, as I was saying. These are some of the fastest growing companies in the country.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. I should ask you about sports, Pavan. Is this something that Indian American parents are especially interested in their kids excelling in? Lots of parents from other demographics are hopeful that their children might receive, say, a sports scholarship.
Right. So a lot of the families I spoke to, and a lot of Asian families, they don't see sports as like a viable venue to make a name for themselves. So a quick step back is to say this. All kinds of parents who are thinking about their kids getting into some kind of selective college want their kids to stand out from peers, right? That's how you do it. So how will my kids stand out in this competitive process for college admissions? Some families will say, well, my kid can really stand out because they're really great on the baseball diamond, or, you know, catching passes to get in the end zone, or whatever else it might be. And that's what they think is the best route for their kids. And that's their own kind of, you know, predilection. And they have the finances to invest in these sports. They'll do that. For other families, and many of the ones I'm talking to, whether they're Asian or white or whatever, they say that's really not the pathway we see for our kids, either because they don't think that their community does well in sports. They don't think that their kids are necessarily going to survive in sports. One parent I spoke to said, you know, my kid has a lot of promise in terms of music, right? And able to, not just in terms of classical music, just like composing and other kinds of things. But I know nothing about the music industry. I can't guide him in that. So I rather guide him in kind of the parts of the upbringing and kind of college resume process that I know the most about, which is more academically minded. So in other words, parents are kind of playing to their strengths, not assuming that they can just guide kids wherever they want to go. So these families that I'm talking about will put their kids in extra academics as a way to stand out, and also partly because that's what they're most comfortable with. They don't think that the other avenues to stand out and outcompete others are as available to them.
We've talked a lot today about the children of immigrant parents. I'm curious as to whether, you know, we're more than half a century out from changes in immigration law. Do Indian American parents born in the U.S. who now have kids of their own, do they tend to reproduce this kind of education strategy for their own kids, or are there noticeable generational differences?
That's a really helpful question, because it does speak to a couple of things. This is not just an immigrant phenomenon in terms of Asians and Indians, but it is more pronounced among the immigrant generation and how they raise their kids. Because growing up in a country where, you know, getting any kind of resource, any kind of advantage meant severe competition, the idea of having to outcompete others for opportunities becomes taken for granted. And that is an immigrant, you know, experience, whereas those who grew up in the U.S. don't have that kind of visceral recollections. And so you're going to see it more pronounced among immigrant generation than you will among those born and raised in the U.S. But having said that, right, if you grew up with kind of a hyper education background, or you think that regardless of my own preferences, my kids are going to be measured at a higher standard because of their race or ethnicity, then you start to be more strategic in your decisions. And it's not, you're not just doing it because that's what feels normal. You're doing it because, well, I'm put in a position where I don't have much of an option. So it's going to happen more, let's say, in the second generation than it would in the general population, possibly, but much less than it will among the immigrants. In fact, if I can quickly share something, just this morning, I had an email from, someone who used to live in Kapil, because they saw me on your program. And this person emailed me, a second generation Indian American, who said, you know, we used to do this kind of hyper education for our kids, thinking this was the best route for their success. And then we kind of started to question, why are we doing this? Is this really best for their mental health? And they pulled back.
My guest is sociologist Pavan Dhingra. He is professor of American Studies at Amherst College and author of Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest, Pavan Dhingra, is a sociologist and professor of American Studies at Amherst College. His book is called Hyper Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. So, Pavan, the economic drivers for all this extra work for kids are pretty clear, right? We hear all the time about the growing importance of a college degree, sometimes even a postgraduate degree, as a hedge against poverty and unemployment. You also found some parents think that keeping their kids busy all the time, at the top of the class, will keep them out of the kind of trouble they hear about other students getting into, drugs and early pregnancy and violence. How do racial stereotypes play into those concerns?
Right. So one that surprised me is when I was talking with families, if you ask families why they do these kinds of activities, they'll tell you the kind of things we've been talking about. But if when you switch the question and I ask them, what do you worry would happen if you stopped doing this? Or what do you think of families who don't do this? They reveal more kind of underlying motivations besides just, you know, good grades and good schools. They think that their children's values, what constitutes good behavior, what kind of people they'll grow up to be, is at stake with what kind of after school activities they choose. And they worry that if our kids didn't do this, right, they may end up getting, you know, they'll be more drawn to things like teen pregnant, you know, dating and making out and possibly teen pregnancy, drugs, alcohol, just basically stopping to caring about school, right? And becoming somewhat feeling entitled and lazy. And the parents don't, which is all that is quite surprising if you think about it, right? These kind of moral goals and values are embedded in these, what seems to be a really kind of straightforward academic pursuit. But if you, you start thinking about what kind of stereotypes they're talking about, even though they don't refer to any particular group as ones they want to avoid, the concerns they have kind of fall on pretty standard anti-Black racial stereotypes that we are kind of embedded in what it means to be a good person versus bad person, right? So families that only care about sports or you know, parents who don't think much about their kids' education, and I can go on and on, right? They fit, the kind of classic problematic anti-Black stereotypes that have become taken for granted about just what it means to be right and wrong kind of parenting, what a right and wrong kind of child. And I wanted to draw that out so we don't lose sight of what could be behind some of these concerns. Now, again, not that these families are referring to this, not that these families are going out of their way to criticize any group, but I felt it important to say, you know, these concerns they have shouldn't just be taken at face value.
How do parents respond to their kids' particular interest when choosing extracurricular activities for them? Does it have to be a sort of school-related subject, or is a kid who's fascinated by dance or drama also indulged in special classes?
For sure. If your kid is interested in dance or drama or art or something else, then those parents will double down on that. That is oftentimes the case. I met a lot of students who were great at spelling bees and also were, you know, amazing classical dancers or something like that, or, you know, jazz dancers. But what's a bit distinguishable here is that while your child may be great at tennis or dance or something else, parents also want their kids to be strong in academics. So they will have their kids in something academic as well as something, you know, artistic or whatever else the child really was begging for or interested in. So, you know, I remember talking to a parent and I said, you know, well, I have kids and they were, when I was doing the research, they were, you know, elementary age, and this is all part of our kind of, you know, landscape as well. And I said to one mother, my kid doesn't really like spelling. I was at a spelling bee. And she said, oh, don't worry about that. You know, just have a new history bees, or have a new something else academic that spoke to his interests. And I said, well, he really likes baseball. You know, we were knee deep in Little League. And she said, that's fine, but you can use baseball as a way to help him learn academics too. Like, in other words, you have to do something academic. Otherwise, the future of your child is somewhat at risk. But that doesn't mean you just do that.
I want to talk a little about how these parental expectations are conveyed and enforced. I don't know any parents of any socioeconomic or racial category that don't say to their kids, I want you to do well in school. It's a priority. This is important for your future. I can tell you as a parent, I said that to my kids. I think I tried to, you know, to represent that to them, but they didn't all turn out to be super devoted students. Is there something about the way Indian American parents are raising their kids that make kids really more receptive to parental pressure in these areas?
There are plenty of Indian American youth who are not academically minded, who don't go to college at all. If they do, they're at community colleges or less selective schools, who don't graduate. You know, they're Indian Americans below the poverty line. So this is not a kind of uniform process or outcome.
Sure.
But when parents are successful in this kind of approach, it's that they make learning a family process and family activity. And I write a lot about that. That is, so if your kid is studying for a competition or an after school, or you just want an after school class, the kid does not feel like they're alone in this. And I have plenty of stories of parents sitting with their kids to, you know, go over what they've been covering, to quiz them, to make games out of it. The whole family will come together and make it a kind of activity. And that makes the child feel much more invested in what they're doing. And so one thing that brings up is that some of the stress that students feel is not necessarily from their parents to achieve. The stress that students can feel is that what's really valued in their families and what they themselves really value is not seen as valuable in the school. So it's like the disconnect between different levels of expectations. So, you know, in other words, you can achieve too much at school, right? We don't think of it that way, but that is true. We have a kind of a notion of how much students should be learning. And when students learn less than that, we say, oh, you have to catch up to grade level. We worry about them. We support them. But students can also achieve more than they're, quote unquote, supposed to. And when that happens, sometimes can be told, hey, you know, you're a nerd, you're a geek, you don't have friends. And even teachers, it's also surprised me, can end up making the students feel awkward for how much they know.
Wow.
And again, this is something I draw attention to in the book, some of the outcomes of this. So some of the stress or concerns in terms of, you know, socially and in terms of emotionally that students experience is not necessarily because they're pushed by their parents. It's that there's the disconnect between what's normal or valued or applauded at home compared to the school.
Does making school success and extracurricular success really a family project require either a stay-at-home parent or a parent who at least is home in the hours when the kids are home?
Right. That is, again, a sign of privilege, that families have the resources to, you know, get the materials you need to study, to or, you know, even something as basic as having an internet connection, which, you know, many of us take for granted. But of course, there is a, you know, not all of us can. And then having a parent or a set of parents who is either home full time or at least it has enough of a, you know, bandwidth in their schedule to sit with the child, make them feel like they're, you know, engaged with them on what they're doing. Not just checking the work, but part of the process as much as the kid wants that to be the case. And then once you have like some child who's doing well in this, that they become like a mentor for their sibling. So families kind of reproduce it in this way. But it is, again, just like the being able to afford, you know, a tutoring company for a couple $100 a month or $100 a month, the privilege of having time, having a workspace, all of these things that remote learning has made all the more obvious to us is a clear sign of privilege. And it's no surprise also given remote learning that this extra education that I'm talking about is growing. This is, again, this is already some of the fastest growing companies before remote learning became, you know, part of our home process and education. But with remote learning growing, I expect to see these tutoring companies, you know, even grow more in terms of popularity across the country for those who can afford them.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Do you think the future of this will be more students who do remote learning exclusively, even after the pandemic doesn't require students to be at a distance from their classmates?
I think that parents, and I'm speaking with my parent hat on at this time as well as my academic hat, you know, we see our kids, they want the in-person engagement, right? I mean, one of my sons has not been inside of a school since March of last year. And you know, clearly they want this. And there's all these, you know, reasons why students should be in person. And I don't think parents are going to, you know, generally speaking, ask for their kids to stay remote once we're hopefully past this, you know, period. But having said that, I think as parents to take make use of extracurricular education now, because they're so much more concerned about what their kids are getting out of school. Once you get on that treadmill of engaging in extracurricular education, it's hard to get off. And so I think that's going to continue, whether that's through remote or in-person instruction. And the reason is that, right, kids get, once they start getting, say, above grade level in a class, in a subject, then if you stop the extracurricular education, then the kid will feel like they're regressing. You'll feel like the kid is regressing. And you don't want that to happen. So once your child gets on this process and shows some advancement in this, you almost feel compelled to continue it. It's hard to know when to stop doing it. And again, if a lot of parents are doing this out of a sense of fear, rather than thinking about it as a sense of opportunity for their kids, well, fear never goes away. And so you're always going to be motivated by that. And one thing I talk about in the book is, like, how to know when tutoring works best for your child, how to make that decision for you, your family. You know, is this time to get a tutor or supplemental education? What kinds of spaces work better? What kinds actually don't have much of a positive impact at all on their kids? So because not all of them are the same.
What did you hear from students about how they feel about being hyper-educated? Were they generally as stressed out as some advocates fear they might be?
Yeah, great question, because at the end of the day, right, this is about the kids, and I spent a lot of time with youth. And, you know, I would say for the most part, they enjoyed what they were doing. And of course, that could be just them telling me this, or they don't want to, you know, and I'm very aware of that. And so I try to find spaces where, you know, we were like set aside from the parents and, you know, say, hey, you know, level with me. Do you really enjoy being at this kind of space? And a lot of them found that, you know, well, I'll put it this way. There's two basic types. Those who kind of make, have some success and achievement in an academic subject tend to enjoy that feeling of success and achievement and want more of it. And they tend to like, you know, the subject overall enough to, you know, put time into it. And so they've seemed quite, you know, well-balanced and fine with it. I talked to a lot of past math and spelling bee champions and finalists, and they're incredibly well-balanced as adults, right? They don't look back on that with, you know, generally speaking, with a bunch of regret. But at the same time, I talked to youth who were clearly at spaces because they were dragged there by their parents. One child was like, you know, yeah, I'd rather be home right now because I'm missing a friend's birthday party. And I said, well, you know, are you going to enjoy being here anyway? Like, is something you'll enjoy about being here? He's like, no, I just want to go home. And one mother was saying, you know, she basically, you know, bribes her child to do the math homework that from the after school center. Like, you can't play soccer until you finish your math homework. So, you know, that's a sign for your child not to be doing this. If you're the one forcing it, if you're the one bribing it, right, if they're pushing back, then you are not helping them in the long run. I talked to a lot of mental health experts, and one said, you know, I see kids who go through this, and what really worries me is that they come to see school and learning as a chore. You ask them, what do they enjoy about school? They say, nothing, I hate it. Right. And that's some of the long-term consequences of having children in hyper-education who don't want to be there.
Pavan Dhingra is a sociologist and professor of American Studies at Amherst College. His new book is called Hyper-Education: Why Good Schools, Good Grades, and Good Behavior Are Not Enough. Pavan, this has been really interesting. Thank you for making the time to talk to us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're also on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @KERAthink. You know, you can subscribe to our podcast. It's free wherever you get podcasts. Just type KERAthink in the search bar or stream the podcast directly from our website, where you can also find out about upcoming shows we're planning. That is think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.